Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week's NATO summit in Chicago got extensive media coverage. Much of it focused on protests and the arrests of three activists facing charges of, quote, conspiring to commit domestic terrorism during the summit. Today's guest, Jana Kunichoff, reports that Michael Deutsch, representing the NATO three and employed by the National Lawyers Guild, has alleged entrapment. He said, quote, "We believe these are fabricated charges that are based on police informants and provocateurs." Jana Kunichoff is assistant editor for truthout.org and reporter with the Chicago Reporter, and she joins us from Chicago. Hi, Jana. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. On the streets of Chicago, the nurses were out in force demanding a financial transaction tax. Activists protested in front of Boeing's Chicago headquarters, and Afghan women marched with 50 veterans who threw their medals at the summit, saying no amount of medals or flags can cover the amount of human suffering caused by the occupation. Arun Gupta, founding editor of the Independent newspaper and co-founder of Occupy the Wall Street Journal, in his latest op-ed for Al Jazeera English, he writes, "Although media coverage has dwindled, Occupy cells are alive and well all over the United States and beyond." Hi, Arun. Welcome back to the show. Oh, I'm sorry. Arun's joining us in about 30 minutes, so we'll be joined by him in just a little while. And who's reporting on what NATO actually does? Representative Dennis Kucinich, who recently lost his re-election bid in Ohio, says NATO is a cost-sharing organization that finances aggressive military action. He writes, quote, "The war in Afghanistan is not ending. These talks are simply about financing the next phase of war." Today's other guest, The Guardian's Afghanistan correspondent Emma Graham Harrison, reports that Afghan officials believe Washington will pay billions of extra dollars for its army and police on top of the main chunk of a $4 billion a year price tag. Emma Graham Harrison joins us from Kabul. Hi, Emma. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for joining us. Well, as we always do on Friday, we like to start off on a positive note and talk about reporting that was done well this week. Jana, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Definitely. I mean, I think, first of all, there were a group of indie media journalists covering NATO that were sort of always on the ground and a lot of the time without any sort of press passes or any of the traditional protections that journalists might get and things like this, who did a lot of really great reporting. So I think a big commendation to all of them. But other than that, there's been a lot of sort of people taking in what happened during the NATO summit and bringing out their analysis on it. So there are a few pieces that I thought were really wonderful there. First of all, Maya Shenoir, who I work with at Truthout, wrote a story about the U.S. 2.3 million, which are the number of people that are incarcerated, about the number of people that are incarcerated at any one moment. And there isn't a lot of media attention around them. They don't necessarily have a big group of activists organizing for them. So what does it mean to have a system that also sort of keeps these people in its jaws?
And I'm glad you brought that one up, because I saw that earlier this week. Can you just give us an overview? Who are these 2.3 million people?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a wide range of people, but a big chunk of people that Maya mentions are people that are incarcerated for drug offenses or nonviolent crimes. And basically sort of victims of this larger war on drugs that's sort of been around since Reagan first set it off. So, you know, she mentions the fact that a lot of people that are in jail are poor, and they went to jail poor, and they'll stay in jail poor. And when they come out of jail, they'll probably still be poor, because having any sort of record, even for a nonviolent offense, immediately makes it that much harder for you to get any sort of job.
And I meant the people who were arrested yesterday. It's an astonishing number. 35,948 arrested in one day in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's just a one-day portion of this much larger number. But yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of those people are, you know, as I mentioned, people that are arrested for nonviolent drug offenses, or people that are in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I was just startled by this. I thought this has to be a mistake. I mean, almost 36,000 people in one day.
I mean, the U.S. has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. So I think that until you actually bring out these numbers, I mean, and that's an insane amount of people. Wow. I mean, that's enough people to keep all of Chicago schools from being overcrowded if they became teachers. You know, it's a lot of people. So I think that looking, like zeroing in on that really gives us an idea of the magnitude.
Well, thank you for that. We will put a link on our website right after the show. And I understand you had one more positivity.
Yeah, there was a story by Alex Zychik in Salon, which I thought actually brought out the other side of things, which was talking about NATO. He was inside the NATO summit itself, so he was talking about NATO and its connection to military defense contractors, which I thought was great because I think that the people that were actually able to get inside the summit, there was some critical reporting. There wasn't a whole lot of it. So I think to look at the role of larger corporate actors in this and see and look critically at how NATO plays into the larger corporatization of defense was really interesting.
And that is, I'm so glad also you brought that one up, because Denis Kucinich was one of the only politicians, to my knowledge, who brought up the connections between the money spent. And so we didn't really hear much. There was a protest in front of the Boeing headquarters. Does he name names and talk about who's profiting off of these billions?
Yeah, he does. Let me can open up his article.
Well, that's okay. We can find it, and we'll link to it, and maybe you can find it, and then we'll talk about it later in the show.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of companies, so I would definitely suggest looking at it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And Emma, I know you have just been swimming in coverage of Afghanistan. What did this look like from your vantage point when you've got these world leaders meeting in one place talking about Afghanistan and you're in Kabul? How do you keep tabs on what's going on?
Well, obviously, I'm lucky in that the Guardian has a pretty big U.S. presence, so I've got a lot of colleagues there who, you know, have the knowledge and the contacts and all of that to really be following it closely and covering it on the ground. And in fact, you know, the majority of our coverage of the summit was done by them. I was just helping out with background and context, really. I mean, a lot of it from our point of view. It didn't feel like we were expecting new developments to come out of the summit. We knew in advance really what we expected to be agreed. It was more for us and for people in Afghanistan, it was seen more as a sort of public show of commitment from NATO and some of the other sort of associated countries who were at the summit to supporting Afghanistan as the combat troops start going home and then beyond their departure. What people were sort of interested in, I guess what people were looking out for, were more the details, what was going to be in the exact wording of the final declaration, which countries would pledge how much money to supporting the Afghan security forces, details like that. But in terms of the main substance of the meeting or the declaration on Afghanistan, we sort of knew what was going to come out of it. It was the sort of political theater that surrounded it, really.
And I want to let listeners know that Emma Graham-Harrison, Afghan correspondent with The Guardian, will be with us for the next 15 minutes or so. So if you'd like to talk now about media coverage of the summit itself and what's in store for the future of Afghanistan, now would be a good time to call. And I'd love to hear, what did you make of the coverage? Did you find analysis pieces about what is actually happening on the ground? And then, as Emma reported, Afghan officials believe Washington will pay billions of extra dollars for the Afghan army and police on top of the main $4.1 billion yearly price tag. Did you see that in much of the reporting? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And also, did you see much reporting about what NATO actually does? What are their goals? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. So what about that question, Emma, about what is actually happening on the ground in Afghanistan? We just got a report yesterday about four aid workers for the international humanitarian organization MedAir, who were kidnapped. In recent months, there have been a series of stories about coordinated attacks by the Taliban. You have a piece about the Taliban for the first time in a very long time, decimating the poppy fields. So can you give us an assessment? How volatile is the situation in Afghanistan right now?
Well, at the moment, we're just at the start of what people here call the fighting season. Usually the fighting really kind of moves up when the snow has melted on the mountain passes. Afghanistan is a very mountainous country. A lot of the insurgents shelter over the border in Pakistan in winter when the foliage that helps provide cover for fighting isn't here. You know, the leaves have died off the fields, the conditions are much harsher, it's harder to sleep out in the open. So right now is when you'd be expecting to see a rise in the intensity of the fighting, the intensity of attacks. So this is sort of a time when everybody's slightly holding their breath to see how bad the fighting is going to be this summer. What you've seen over the last few years has been a very local security picture. There's been areas, particularly where there's been a focus of the US-led military surge, where security has improved, particularly some areas in the south. Equally, you've seen other parts of the country where for different reasons, people are feeling less secure. It might not be directly related to the insurgency. Sometimes you also have criminal violence here. It's a country where you're legally allowed to own some types of guns, and there are a lot of guns around. So there's not just insurgent-linked violence, there's also criminal-linked violence. But yes, it's definitely a mixed picture across the country in terms of security, but
Emma, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. So it's a mixed picture across the country, but it's certainly now you'd be expecting to see the fighting picking up.
How do you juxtapose what is happening on the ground, what you see, what you hear in Kabul, with the rhetoric we hear in the U.S.? For example, President Obama at the NATO summit said, quote, "I don't think there's ever going to be an optimal point where we say this is all done, this is perfect, this is just the way we wanted it. This is a process, and it's sometimes a messy process." I mean, this is what we're getting from U.S. officials. They're not being specific. They're just sort of saying this is messy.
Well, obviously, you have a difficult situation where maybe a few years ago, the goals of all kind of, a lot of the foreign officials who were involved in Afghanistan were perhaps a little higher. They were more ambitious in terms of what they hoped to achieve, both militarily and politically. I think there's now an understanding that the strength of the insurgency means that it's not, there's no possibility that the Western forces are going to leave a country which the Afghan government is in full control of. There's going to be an insurgency, and what they're aiming for is a situation where the Afghan police and the Afghan army are strong enough to fight that insurgency largely on their own, with Western financial support and Western training. But essentially the boots on the ground are Afghan, not foreign.
Right. And the U.S. has 90,000 of the 130,000 foreign forces in Afghanistan. President Obama has pledged to shrink that to about 68,000 by the end of September. But according to the AP, he's offered no details on the withdrawal pace after that, other than to say it'll be gradual. And we're talking today with Emma Graham Harrison. She is The Guardian's Afghan correspondent. We're also joined by Yana Kunichov, assistant editor for Truthout and reporter with The Chicago Reporter. And Emma will be with us for about 10 more minutes from Kabul. So if you have any questions or comments about reporting on the ground in Afghanistan, if you have questions about what she sees there, now would be a good time to call. And if you have any comments about the media coverage of NATO the last week or so, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Yana, I'm wondering, do you have any questions for Emma about the reporting that she's doing in Afghanistan?
Yeah, actually, you know, I would be interested to know how much the understanding of the regular Afghan is, you know, when there's forces out there, the difference between the U.S. forces or the NATO forces or any other country, or is there just sort of this homogenous understanding of them, and actually how often regular Afghans come into contact with the forces that are there on the ground?
Hi, thanks for the question. In some ways, it's a little bit hard for me to answer it because a lot of these troops are out in areas where the security isn't great. One of the great problems and challenges of being a reporter in Afghanistan is that movement is very limited. You know, you can embed with NATO forces, and particularly the Americans are generally very good at arranging access to most of their forces. But traveling independently beyond certain areas is difficult. So in a lot of the country, unfortunately, the only way you can interact with the Afghans is if you're embedded with NATO forces. So obviously, you know, when you're standing next to a soldier, you have to assume that the person you're speaking to is going to be filtering their opinion somewhat. In Kabul, I'd say, you know, which is the capital, people, the level of education here is much higher. You know, people are aware of the different forces. But yes, often, you know, in the villages, people tend to see, I have been to places where people just sort of refer to all foreign forces as Americans. And I don't know if in places where, you know, say the Italians are fighting or the Poles, if people are really aware that those are, you know, European soldiers rather than Americans.
And what are you hearing from Afghans at this point? I mean, the invasion began in the weeks after September 11th, 2001, and here we are in 2012. What stories do they want to be told at this point?
Well, you know, Afghanistan, like any country, is an incredibly diverse place, you know, perhaps more than most countries. It's got a pretty big population, around 30 million, although no one really knows exactly. And, you know, you have different ethnic groups, people who speak different languages. You know, it goes from, you know, people in Kabul who have university educations, who've traveled internationally, to people who've lived in isolated villages, who've probably never gone farther than perhaps the nearest market town, if they're lucky, who maybe have never even left their village, who can't read or write. So obviously, you know, when you have that much of a diverse population, what people want is also, I would say, very diverse. People's understanding of the war is also tempered to a degree by their education. There was a very interesting poll that was done in the south, in Helmand, by an organization called ICOS a couple of years ago now. I can't remember the exact figures, but a surprising number of people weren't even aware of what 9/11 was. They didn't recognize pictures of the Twin Towers. So obviously, with people who you know, who haven't, for whatever reason, don't know about the reason that troops originally came to Afghanistan, you know, that their understanding of why they're here would be very different from perhaps somebody who was in Kabul. I think there are people who hope that the departure of foreign troops might perhaps bring some kind of peace. They feel that, you know, despite good intentions, perhaps, you know, the presence of foreign troops exacerbates the war. There are people who are very worried that, you know, the departure of foreign troops could mean that they lose rights, you know, women in particular, rights that they've gained over the last 10 years. And, you know, the Taliban are not, you know, might not be popular in places like Kabul, but, you know, that they do have support in some parts of the country. So, you know, you have to factor in that, you know, that they are also a group with constituents in Afghanistan who support them.
Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's try to get through as many as we can in the next couple of minutes. Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Thank you. I have a question regarding when and how it would have been possible to to establish a more beneficial relationship between the United States and Afghanistan and NATO countries in Afghanistan. And the reason that I ask this is because if all of us got involved in a country that was so poor and had such little infrastructure, the simple task of rebuilding the infrastructure, which, of course, would create millions of jobs among the Afghani. I'm not exaggerating when I say millions to rebuild the country. Mm-hmm. There was, a definite time period in which we could have established a much more better working relationship with Afghanistan and help to build a more strong and independent nation. Was that possible? Was there a window when that was possible? What would it have looked like?
Emma, were you able to hear Robert?
Yeah, he was just asking if there was perhaps a time in the last 10 years when it would have been possible to have a more positive relationship developing between the international community and Afghanistan.
Right.
And the Afghan government.
Right.
There's certainly lots of points in the past 10 years you can point to where decisions were made that in hindsight probably weren't very beneficial for Afghanistan. And, you know, a lot of diplomats here think that one of the big problems was that when the invasion of Iraq happened, the attention of the international community was sort of taken off Afghanistan, both in terms of just political attention and also financial resources. You can sort of question decisions that were made right back to, for instance, the electoral system. There's people who feel that Afghanistan would be better off if it had a prime minister as well as a president, perhaps, or a parliamentary system. The parliamentary system here is not very conducive to forming political parties. There's a system called single non-transferable votes, which means you end up with a parliament full of people with much looser allegiances than you'd have, say, you know, in the U.S. Houses of Congress or in the British Parliament. And, you know, that decision was made back in, I believe, 2002. So, I mean, I think, yes, there's been a history of mistakes of many different kinds, from, you know, perhaps political mistakes, diplomatic mistakes, choice of resources. One thing that I've seen that I personally think has been a mistake made by the international community is that a lot of the resources that we spent on development, on road building, school building, things like that, were spent in provinces where there was unrest or instability with the idea of, you know, sort of convincing the population of the benefits that the central government could bring to them, winning hearts and minds, and sort of, you know, the cliched phrase. So what you have is places like Bamiyan, which I visited a couple of weeks ago, which is probably one of the most peaceful places in Afghanistan. It's absolutely beautiful. It's also desperately poor and has had very, very little money. It's only about 170 kilometers from Kabul, and yet the road isn't even paved. So bringing supplies in of any kind, even, you know, basic foodstuff, is expensive and very difficult. I think that the choice of where to spend resources is for me one of maybe the biggest mistakes we've made. Areas that where you could have seen greater progress in development because you had a more stable base didn't perhaps get the resources they could have had.
All right. Well, thank you, Robert. And I just want to mention Emma has an incredible piece about Afghan students learning the centuries-old skills that carved out the giant Buddhas in this area that were blown up. So, Emma, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting. I especially enjoyed reading that piece. Thank you. Emma Graham Harrison is with The Guardian. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco, and we would like to thank everyone who made our May membership campaign a success. More than 2,500 listeners, including 585 new members, pledged a total of over $261,000 to support local public radio. And because of that support, KALW is on track to end the fiscal year with a modest surplus. Listeners who decide to get involved and make everything possible at this station, KALW, and thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we will rebroadcast our conversation with Frank Bardacchi, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. And then on Tuesday, we'll have a conversation about a new documentary about food stamps. Today, it's our media roundtable. And we are joined today by Yana Kunichoff, assistant editor for Truth Out and reporter with the Chicago Reporter. And she is in Chicago. She was covering the protests, covering surveillance in Chicago. This didn't get much attention. We'll talk about that. And if you have any comments about how NATO was covered last week, did you see much coverage of the on-the-ground activism? The nurses were out in force. There was a protest in front of Boeing's Chicago headquarters. Afghan women marched with 50 veterans who threw their medals at the summit. Did you see that kind of reporting? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it. And we've had some nice interaction in the last couple weeks. And Yana, I just wanted to ask you before we talk about the protests. I read so many articles about NATO, and it was incredible to see this $4.1 billion number missing from so much of the coverage. But here we are having massive budget cuts in this country. People with disabilities are losing their in-home supportive services. You name it, and there's cuts. And yet the U.S. is going to pay for most of the share of this expected $4 billion annual budget. This price tag. I just didn't see this reported in many of the articles. Did you?
You know, not really. I think that was sort of one of the main problems with the way that the NATO summit was reported. There were a lot of numbers running around, especially in local Chicago media, about how much the summit would end up costing the city. But there weren't a lot of places that stepped back and took a much larger picture, which I think if you consider the role in NATO, the role that U.S. plays in NATO, which I believe the U.S. Funds like 70% of the military spending of NATO, then I think you can't report this story without taking a much bigger step back and looking at the whole thing.
And how was it covered in Chicago? Was there a step back to kind of, because it was, this is a huge event that came to Chicago. Was there much coverage of, you know, how it affects Chicagoans, for example, Chicagoans, I should say. For example, it would be, I mean, if I were a reporter in Chicago, I would want to look at budget cuts in Chicago and then compare that to the money that's being spent on the military.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there were some coverage of that in sort of what you'd consider the more mainstream press in Chicago. But I think for the most part, there was a lot of talk about how this would be a big inconvenience. So there were discussions about roads that would be closed. It was a very much of sort of a single issue reporting on how this would affect normal Chicagoans in terms of road closures and also just what it would look like when the protesters came to the city. So I think that the bigger picture of the fact that there's this big national event happening here wasn't reported. And I also think the fact that there's this big expensive event coming here that's also connected to, you know, a lot of military spending there also wasn't a lot of reporting about what has been happening on the ground in Chicago in the last few weeks, more generally, which is the closing of clinics, the closing of public schools, the closing of libraries. So I think that a lot of places didn't bring that together when they did their Chicago coverage, and they weren't going to bring it together when the NATO summit came either.
Right. And people with disabilities did have a protest to demand to keep mental health clinics open because they are closing.
Yeah, I mean, I think most groups that were affected there was a day of action for education and foreclosure, and a lot of the communities that are hurt by budget cuts came out and connected their suffering to NATO, but those weren't always the connections that were made in the report.
And that is Yana Kunichoff, assistant editor for Truth Out and reporter with the Chicago Reporter. And now I would like to welcome Arun Gupta to the show. Arun is founding editor of the Independent newspaper, co-founder of Occupy the Wall Street Journal. He also writes for Al Jazeera English. Hi, Arun. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you today.
It's great to have you. So I want to ask you the same question, Arun. What are your thoughts on the media really focusing on what NATO actually does? Because Denis Kucinich put out a release saying NATO talks a sham. War in Afghanistan is not ending. He writes, quote, NATO leaders are meeting in Chicago. The talks are being billed as discussions of plans to end the war. The war in Afghanistan is not ending. These talks are simply about financing the next phase of war. Did any of that make it into the coverage?
I'm sure in some places it might have, but in terms of what I saw, virtually none. There were some vague references. The day of the protest, I ended up watching one of the local news stations, NBC News, and they had expanded their evening newscast to about an hour. And it was actually quite remarkable. It was virtually information-free. The only thing one could take away with it from it was how restrained the police were. They literally used that about 20 or 30 times during the hour-long news broadcast, how incredibly restrained, extremely restrained. It was all about what a great job that the police did. It was a very kind of just a propagandistic broadcast, very much just preaching the ideology of state power. And it's treated like much of the reporting in this country is essentially a sporting match, the way that the presidential contest is, you know, the way the protests were treated in the same way, that it's the police versus the black bloc, you know, that somehow these are two equal forces. And then what gets left out is what exactly NATO does, what's going on. But I think that's because these things have been effectively insulated from the public at large. You know, something like maybe 0.5% of Americans actually serve in the active U.S. military. And the number of casualties is quite low since the U.S. War started to shift in Iraq. Back in 2007, you know, you do see a few hundred deaths a year in Afghanistan, but really it's nothing that breaks through the media, through the news cycle in any significant way.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that stood out also in a lot of the articles we've been reading, the amount of praise given to the Chicago Chief of Police, Chief Gary McCarthy. The AP's headline, Chicago Police Get High Marks for NATO Protests. Chicago Tribune, Chicago Police Erase 1968 Stain at Last with NATO Summit. And then Crane's Chicago Business, Chicago Police Chief McCarthy praises officers for NATO work. Yana, what are your thoughts on this? And also in some of the articles, they mocked the protesters.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised about what the coverage eventually ended up being like around the Chicago police, but I was. I think that what this has effectively done is switch the conversation, sort of move the goalposts of what we consider acceptable, which is something that one of my colleagues at Truth Out has written a lot about. We were sort of told that it was going to be like 1968 all over again. There was a fear of black blockers that was sort of stoked by media in the city in the weeks leading up. And when that didn't happen, and though there were, I mean, on Sunday alone, there were 70 complaints of police misconduct made to the National Lawyers Guild. But when that was 70 instead of a couple hundred, we were told that means that the Chicago Police Department should be patted on the back. And I also think that this coverage and sort of lionizing Gary McCarthy, who's the Chicago Police Superintendent, the Sun-Times had a story that basically started with Chicago has a new hero, completely forgets what the police do in communities of color in Chicago around the city all the time. There were actually two police killings of unarmed civilians just a month or two before the NATO summit came, and neither of those police have yet been disciplined in any way. So I think that focusing on this one side with all the force also means that there's no real understanding of who the protesters were, what they were coming from, or any effort to really hear their side of the story.
That is Yana Kunichoff, assistant editor with Truth Out and reporter with the Chicago Reporter. Arun Gupta is founding editor of The Independent newspaper and co-founder of Occupy, the Wall Street Journal. He also writes for Al Jazeera English. You can find his latest piece, What Happened to the Occupy Movement, at yourcallradio.org, and we'll speak with him about that in just a couple minutes. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798 8255. If you have any questions or comments about the coverage you saw of NATO and these issues, we'd love to hear from you. And then if there was another story you saw this week that you think deserves more attention, give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also leave a link or a comment at yourcallradio.org, or if you'd rather, feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Heidi, who was at the summit in Chicago, and she's calling from Big Sur. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So I wasn't actually at the summit, but I was in Chicago by accident, and I did pay attention to the coverage. And I watched TV news, and I read the Chicago Tribune, and it was all about the protesters and the police and the conflict between the protesters and the police. And just as an example, on Monday, May 21st, which was technically the end of the summit when everyone was leaving, the front page on the Chicago Tribune, to their credit, topic one, Afghanistan. They do have news about the summit, but most of it, the pictures, big photo spreads, was all about the conflict between the police and the protesters, and very little about the summit. There were also some great photo ops because they were really promoting the city of Chicago as, you know, hosting this international event and what it would do to put the city on the map, and, you know, made a big deal about that. The only real coverage I saw about, the people who, the op-ed people kind of wrote columns about, it was kind of much ado about nothing. And there was, there must have been, you know, I don't know how many millions of dollars spent on police from all over the state. And they really wanted to keep a wrap on things. And I kind of informally asked different people, you know, their opinion about the protesters and, you know, including a Chicago traffic cop. And people seemed to be against the protesters because they thought the protesters were going to be violent and disruptive. And, you know, there was a lot of praise, like you said, for the police captain, and not in favor of the protesters.
Well, thank you for calling in with your personal experience, Heidi. And it seems like, based on Arun's reporting, that this is the theme that we're hearing across the country. Arun, you point out that CNN has declared May Day fizzled. The New York Post sneered goodbye Occupy. The New York Times consigned the day's events to fewer than 400 words. And this is what you're talking about, the May Day protests. But you have traveled around the country, going to different Occupy movements, talking with people. What does the media coverage across the country look like? And is there a difference between what we're seeing in the national media and the local media?
Well, I don't think you're seeing a lot of difference in the local media either. It's pretty much dried up. And one could argue, you know, this is because the Occupy movement didn't move into electoral politics like the Tea Party did. So I think that's kind of a little bit of a false equivalency, because it's more that the Republican Party was very much able to essentially co-opt the Tea Party brand, which is why it continues to survive in some form. My partner and I have found is that there is a huge amount of activity still going on around the country. It just doesn't get very much coverage because it doesn't fit into a particular narrative, or it actually takes work for the media to go out to find it. Or, you know, part of the real reason is because a lot of it is community organizing and dealing with real problems on the ground. And the corporate are not interested in covering that. You know, they're not really interested in talking about school closures or systematic police brutality, or, you know, the cuts to various services. They exist as profit-making enterprises, and so they cover the things that return profit. You know, they cover finance and personal health care and sports, or they'll cover different festivals or you know, write reviews of restaurants. Mm-hmm. These are the things, the fluffy little things that you know, are of a little bit of interest, but for the corporate media, more important is what produces profit for them. Mm-hmm. It's what gets them eyeballs. It's not very controversial. And so I think, you know, the fact that the Occupy movement has been kind of going deeper into community organizing is very significant and is an important step in terms of moving forward. But we shouldn't read the lack of media coverage that as somehow that it has disappeared. But at the same time, this does create a problem for the Occupy movement because its initial growth very much depended upon huge media coverage. And if it's not able to get the word out in a systematic way, the danger is that you just kind of have the committed hardcore activists who are doing work. You have all sorts of energized movements around education, environmental issues, home foreclosure defense, you know, attempts to hold the big banks accountable. And there's even this campaign to break up, to force the government to break up the Bank of America. But it will only gather momentum if you do draw in a large part of the public. And
right.
The Occupy movement does not have its own national media infrastructure in which it can do that. Mm.
And also, just this week, President Obama was in Silicon Valley. He raised $4 million in just a couple hours. There were protesters there. And then Representative Paul Ryan, the Republican, was also in San Francisco raising money at a $5,000 per plate breakfast. And Single Payer Action Network activists were also there. So there is so much activity going on the streets, but it doesn't always get attention. Going back to what happened in Chicago and the arrests, Yana, you report, and I have not read this anywhere, you report in your Truth Out piece that Chicago has one of the most advanced surveillance systems in the country with cameras that have facial recognition and automatic tracking software. Did this piece of the story get much attention?
I don't think it did. And I think actually that the surveillance system that Chicago has and also some of the other ordinances that were put in place to sort of restrict protests before the NATO summit are really important to understanding what dissent will look like in the city for weeks to come. Mostly because the NATO summit has come, it's gone, $55 million was spent to put it on, and now we actually still have all these fairly repressive measures still in place. So the first one is Rahm Emanuel's sit down and shut up ordinance, which restricted the length of protests, it restricted it doubled some of the fines for protesters involved in protests if they were arrested, and it also made it more difficult for people to apply for a permit. That's still in place, and the reasoning for that was the NATO summit. And then the surveillance system, which I think is the biggest in the country, is completely still in place. And I think what that basically means is that if you came out to Chicago to protest, then it's very likely that the contours of your face are saved somewhere in a computer, and that there are other agencies around the country and around the state that also have access to that information. Through fusion centers or through database sharing or through any number of things. So Chicago has about 15,000 cameras overall, I think is the rough count from the American Civil Liberties Union. And those, again, those have Zoom technology, facial recognition, and like biometrics, and they can also actually sense when there's a group forming in any part of the city because they have such a complete overview of the city that if there's a group of more than 20 people forming anywhere, there's an alert towards like security surveillance in Chicago. So, I mean, that's a lot of eyes on the street.
Well, and speaking of the ACLU, the Daily Beast, Jim Warren, has a piece in which he talks about the Rahm Emanuel administration and representatives of protesters, including the ACLU of Illinois, had a pre-summit negotiation in which Harvey Grossman, the ACLU's legal director, sat down with the city after it made some early missteps and prompted controversy. He writes those included ratcheting up various fines and putting one key venue off limits, Ultimately, the city would not agree to set aside a protest area very close to the actual summit. But important other concessions evidenced flexibility, according to Harvey Grossman with the ACLU. They included the routes for marchers, a willingness to countenance civil disobedience, and the disclosure of many police procedures, including not using detentions in a preventative fashion, meaning not keeping those arrested locked up in a cell all weekend. So it sounds like they made a deal here. And why didn't this get more media coverage?
You know, I don't know if I would say that there was as much of a deal made as there seems to be. I think that some of that plays into the understanding of, you know, Rahm Emanuel as mayor takes a big step towards restricting dissent, and then he moves back a little bit, and then there's sort of a sense of applause for the fact that he didn't, you know, say that it was fine to keep people detained for longer to restrict protests. But I think that what we actually saw in the days before the protests were numerous activists that were approached by the FBI, had the FBI come to their house, were arrested or were questioned, as well as the NATO six who are detained on terrorism charges. And I think that those things all actually did end up stifling dissent. But outside of that, I think that there also just wasn't a lot of coverage around the rights of the protesters, and there wasn't coverage that, you know, even in any underlying way, sort of put forward that there is a right to dissent and there's a right to assemble that the protesters have. That wasn't really something that most of the mainstream media covering this seemed to take as a right that people had.
Well, it sounds like, according to this Daily Beast report, that the ACLU agreed to limit civil disobedience. Is that right?
You know, I haven't read that report, so I can't say. I think that there are some organizations that that were working with the city and were looking for ways to come to a better agreement for what the laws actually look like on paper, much the same way that when organizers were vying to get a permit, they, you know, they came to an agreement with the city to make sure that there were legal protections on the ground. Mm-hmm. But I think that at the same time, the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild were putting out their phone number and had observers on the ground. And so there was obviously a sense in which it isn't just about what's written on the paper. It's actually about following what happens on the ground when these protests actually came out.
All right. Well, we've got just a couple minutes, and I just want to mention one recommendation from Robert. And he suggests we read an article from the World Socialist website called Filmmaker Catherine Bigelow Offered Access to U.S. Military Death Squads. Reports surfaced this week indicating that filmmaker Catherine Bigelow, who won an Academy Award for directing The Hurt Locker, met with Pentagon and CIA officials and was offered access to the Navy SEAL team that executed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan on May 2nd, 2011. So thank you for that. Very interesting, Robert. We'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to another couple callers. We've got about 5 minutes left. Let's hear from Omar in Oakland. Hi, Omar. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I'm an activist with Occupy Oakland. I just want to talk a little bit about, I wanted to sort of echo some of the things that Arun said. And what I've noticed sort of here in the Bay Area, especially in Oakland with local media, is there's sort of a microcosm of what's going on at the national level with all the worst elements kind of to a more intense degree. They're really obligated to the powerful. So they have like two poles. They have sensationalism. So if it bleeds, it leads type reporting. And they have press release-driven news from powerful government and business elites. So they don't really do well with kind of systemic violence. I'm talking about the murder of a young man, Alan Bluford, who was an 18-year-old student at Skyline High School, ready to graduate, and he was murdered on May 6th. And so what you see is there's very little reporting on that. I think there was one article in the entire newspaper system here in Oakland.
Just one article?
Yeah, there was one article the next day.
Wow.
And so what you see is the media don't want to investigate someone killed by the police. They will investigate murder and crime. They really love that if there's powerful interest keeping them from that. But if the police chief or mayor doesn't send out a press release or doesn't give them a nudge, they don't report on these kinds of systemic violence from the city or police.
And Omar, I understand there's an action about that murder tonight.
Well, the action is, and this is another thing they didn't cover, the police chief had a very self-serving question and answer forum at a church in East Oakland where people weren't allowed to actually ask questions of him. They could only send in cards, write in cards at the beginning, and then he would read the cards and give an answer and wouldn't respond to the questions coming from the audience, the further questions. And so there was an activist from Occupy Oakland named Chris Moreland, a young African-American from Oakland, not much older than Alan Bluford, who was agitated about it, very angry at a bullhorn, and he was kind of yelling at the police chief. The police chief wrapped up the meeting early, and then Chris went to the BART station to go home about 20 minutes later and was arrested by police for what happened at that church. And he was charged with just incredibly egregious charges. I mean, he was charged with battery of a police officer. He was charged with assault with a deadly weapon. And the only thing, and this is really incredibly ironic, the only thing he really had on his person was a bullhorn. And so he was literally charged with assaulting Howard Jordan, the police chief here, with free speech.
You know, Omar, we only have
a... He's in jail, and he has a $100,000 bail. So
he's
tonight
still...
at 7 p.m.
Okay, go ahead.
There will be a march from starting at night. There's a park at 19th and Telegraph. That march will start at 19th and Telegraph and head over to the police station on 7th and Washington.
All right, I've got to cut you off because we have about 30 seconds left. Can you please email information to feedback@yourcallradio.com, and then we'll put info on our website. Arun, just quick 30-second response to what you just heard from Omar.
I don't think any of that is really surprising. I mean, we've seen all sorts of surveillance, repression, raids. In New York, there were a number of preemptive raids before May Day. I think what's really going on is that there is the FBI and different surveillance agencies are now essentially bringing the war on terror to the Occupy movement. This has come out in reams of documents.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Sorry to cut you off. We'll definitely continue following this. Arun Gupta and Yana Kunichov, thank you both for joining us. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. Farm workers organizing to claim their power. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast our conversation with Frank Bardacki, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez, and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. We'll talk about the history of the UFW and how it's changed over the years. The book features interviews with farm workers, organizers, friends, and opponents of the UFW. What can we learn from recent victories, and what issues are farm workers organizing around today? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, former Senator and Basketball Hall of Famer Bill Bradley shares his new text, We Can All Do Better. Writer Alice Randall tackles weight loss in her new novel, Ada's Rules. And Valerie Simpson of Ashford and Simpson shares her new CD, Dinosaurs Are Coming Back Again, on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up at noon here on KALW San Francisco, followed at 1 o'clock by Smiley and West. The time is 11 o'clock. We take you next to the BBC World Service for World Have Your Say. On KALW San Francisco on the web, you can find us at kalw.org. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Jill McGivering. Welcome to World Have Your Say. How much aid should the US give Pakistan?
America should just recognize every state's individuality, and the best way to fight off terrorism is fighting together. It's teamwork. It cannot be done individually.
The row between the US and Pakistan is getting hotter. Yesterday, you discussed the sentencing of Shaquille Afridi to 33 years in prison. He's a Pakistani doctor convicted of treason. Now the US has responded by cutting $33 million in aid. It's part of a much bigger package worth $1 billion. It's making some of you question the whole policy of US aid to Pakistan. Is this money well spent? Or, given the state of relations, would you like to see bigger cuts? Should aid get caught up in political rows in the first place? Call us on country code 44 20 70 83 72.